Card didn't answer the question directly. Instead, he tried to crack a joke. "Let me put it this way," he said. "Every morning I knock on the door of the Oval Office, walk in, and say, 'Pardon me, Mr. President.' And, of course, the only person the President can't pardon is himself." Card giggled after he said this, but his joke landed with a thud. The White House chief of staff, when asked whether President Bush would protect CIA officers from legal scrutiny, had suggested that the most they might be able to rely on is a presidential pardon after the indictments and the convictions were handed down. At the CIA, pardon jokes don't go down well. Some of President Bush's aides began to see the CIA as a problem. The agency's director was doing battle with the White House over the detention program, and Vice President Cheney had become convinced that CIA analysts secretly opposed the war in Iraq and were leaking negative assessments about the war to members of Congress and the press. As much as Bush and Cheney had originally tried to resist pressure by the 9/11 Commission to create a Director of National Intelligence to take control over all 16 American spy agencies, some at the White House saw an ancillary benefit of the new position. It put the CIA in its place. A weakened CIA presented an opportunity for Donald Rumsfeld. The worsening situation in Iraq had dampened some of the triumphalism among Rumsfeld and his staff, but the defense secretary continued with his efforts to wage war far from declared war zones in countries that historically had been the CIA's turf. In 2004, Rumsfeld issued a secret directive, known internally at the Pentagon as the Al-Qaeda Network Execute Order, that expanded the powers of special operations troops to kill, capture, and spy in more than a dozen countries. The order gave Joint Special Operations Command, the unit based at Fort Bragg that Rumsfeld had come to identify as a new model army for the post-September 11 era, broad authority to launch operations across an arc of territory from North Africa all the way to the Philippines. It allowed them to go into Syria, Somalia, and Pakistan. Under the new authorities, the missions were highly classified, seldom publicly acknowledged, and irregularly briefed to members of Congress. Joint Special Operations Command was now one of the brightest stars in the Defense Department firmament, and the budget for special operations more than doubled over 6 years, reaching nearly $8 billion in 2007. This was still just a sliver of the Pentagon's budgets for buying ships and jets, but the infusion of money allowed JSOC not only to build more platoons of secret troops, but also to spend money on supplies and logistics that would allow Navy SEALs and Delta Force operatives to sustain clandestine operations for days or weeks on end. No longer was JSOC capable merely of 24-hour hostage rescue missions. It could run wars of its own. JSOC was proving as much in Iraq. There, Lieutenant General Stanley McChrystal's task force had been handed the mission of attacking the Al-Qaeda franchise in the country led by Jordanian terrorist Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. Wave upon wave of deadly violence was washing over the country, and al-Zarqawi's Al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia had claimed responsibility for devastating attacks on American troop convoys and Shiite holy sites. Within months of the beginning of the insurgency, it became clear to commanders on the ground that the war would be sucking American troops into the country for years, and Rumsfeld and his senior intelligence advisor, Stephen Cambone, gave JSOC a long leash to try to neutralize what had become the Iraqi insurgency's most lethal arm. The mantra of the task force, based inside an old Iraqi Air Force hangar at Balad Air Base north of Baghdad, was "Fight for Intelligence." In the beginning, the white dry erase boards that McChrystal and his team had set up to diagram the terror group were blank. McChrystal realized that much of the problem came from the poor communication between the various American military commands in Iraq, with few procedures in place to share intelligence with one another. "We began a review of the enemy and of ourselves," he would later write. "Neither was easy to understand." Just how little everyone knew was apparent in 2004, amid reports that Iraqi troops had captured al-Zarqawi near Fallujah. Since nobody knew exactly what the Jordanian terrorist looked like, he was released by accident. But a campaign plan eventually developed. Night raids against al-Zarqawi's network were designed not just to kick down a door and spray gunfire in all directions. McChrystal believed that what was important was not body count, but the intelligence that could be gathered through interrogations and computer forensics at the spot of the raid. The intelligence trail could then be followed to the next suspected safe house, where more senior al-Qaeda operatives were hiding. "Put a needle into one vein," the theory went, "and you can learn about the entire system." McChrystal tried to ensure that his task force wasn't crippled by the same rivalries that had hurt special operations missions in Afghanistan. He courted CIA officers in Iraq and convinced a senior CIA officer to sit beside him each morning for the task force's daily battlefield update. Thousands of miles away, analysts working in a nondescript government building in Fairfax, Virginia, each day sifted through the intelligence from the previous night's raids in Iraq that had been extracted from thumb drives, cell phones, and computer hard drives. Over time, the dry erase boards filled up with the names and aliases of al-Zarqawi's operatives. The various names were connected by lines drawn with black marker. Everyone's best guess about how an amorphous terror network carried out its business. JSOC's rapid growth was aided by an internal Pentagon study commissioned by Rumsfeld and completed in 2005. The report recommended that the military must increase capabilities and capacities to conduct sustained operations in multiple, sensitive, non-permissive, and denied areas. Translated from military speak, wage simultaneous secret wars in as many places as possible. Written by former JSOC commander General Wayne Downing and Michael G. Vickers, a former CIA clandestine officer who had gained a degree of fame when his role in running guns to Afghanistan during the Soviet War was detailed in the book Charlie Wilson's War, the report had instant currency with Rumsfeld. Its primary conclusion was that special operations troops should take a greater role in the Bush administration's war against al-Qaeda and other terror groups. Special operations troops were well positioned in Iraq and Afghanistan, it concluded, but not the wars of the future. "The future fight," it read, "will take place in countries with which we are not at war." The Pentagon had even begun carrying out risky spying missions inside Iran. Taking advantage of the commercial traffic crossing Iraq's eastern border into Iran, special operations troops were paying agents to cross the border using phony cover stories to collect intelligence about military installations inside western Iran. The foreign agents were both Iranian Muslims and Coptic Christians who could easily get past Iranian border security, telling stories about their plan to buy truckloads full of fruit or other merchandise inside Iran. With such limited cross-border forays, it was difficult for the Pentagon to get truly valuable intelligence from these missions, and the Pentagon wasn't authorized to conduct any sabotage operations or to kill Iranian Revolutionary Guard troops. "The real goal," said a senior Pentagon intelligence official during that period, "was to build up as much of an intelligence network as possible inside Iran, a network that could be tapped if President Bush or one of his successors decided to invade the country. Like so many other military missions in undeclared war zones, the operations in Iran were justified as preparation of the battlefield." The work of soldiers and spies was becoming increasingly blurred. The CIA still had more expansive authorities than the Pentagon to carry out missions anywhere in the world. But after Rumsfeld's 2004 order, it became harder to see real differences between the mission of the military and the mission of the CIA. McChrystal had developed a good rapport with American spies inside of Iraq, but the military's missions into Iran had not been coordinated with the CIA, and with so many secret operatives crawling around the world's darkest corners, the lack of coordination created the potential for a major catastrophe. Or a missed opportunity. After Donald Rumsfeld called off the 2005 Bajor mission in Pakistan because he thought that the hastily planned operation was freighted with too much risk, both the Pentagon and CIA conducted an inquest to figure out what had gone wrong and to make sure the debacle wouldn't be repeated. The review determined that there were no established procedures in place for authorizing an emergency mission into a country beyond Iraq and Afghanistan. The Pentagon and CIA were carrying out parallel secret operations across the globe, but neither the Defense Secretary nor the CIA Director had the authority to take charge when an opportunity arose to launch a secret mission into a country such as Pakistan. Over the next year, the Pentagon and CIA tried to work out a division of labor, carving up the world and determining who was in charge of each front of the secret war. Stephen Cambone led negotiations for the Pentagon, and Deputy CIA Director Vice Admiral Albert Calland was in charge of the CIA team. Whether the CIA or JSOC would be in charge of secret operations in a particular country depended on a variety of factors. How willing was that country to allow special operations troops on its soil? What was the strength of the relationship between the CIA and a country's spy service? Just how prickly might a specific CIA station chief be about ceding control in his country to JSOC? Because of the Bajor episode, Pakistan was at the top of the list for the negotiators. President Musharraf had given his blessing to drone strikes, but he still vehemently opposed American combat operations in the tribal areas. It was fine for things to fall out of the sky, but not for them to come marching over the border from Afghanistan. Trying to sell Musharraf on special operations ground campaigns in places like North Waziristan and Bajor was, most people in Washington agreed, a hopeless endeavor. The CIA proposed a solution. In order to get special operations troops into Pakistan, they would simply be turned over to the CIA and operate under Title 50 Covert Action Authority. Special operations troops would be sheep-dipped. The SEALs would become spies. Special operations troops would be able to launch operations into Pakistan, and Musharraf would never be told. As one former CIA officer described the arrangement, the special operations troops basically became the CIA director's armed platoon. The exact same trick would be used 6 years later when helicopters carrying teams of Navy SEALs took off from Jalalabad, Afghanistan, and crossed the border into Pakistan for the raid that would kill Osama bin Laden. That night, the SEALs were under CIA authority, and CIA Director Leon E. Panetta was technically in charge of the mission. In other countries, it was JSOC that was in control, and commando missions escalated in countries like the Philippines, where special operations troops were already posted. In 2006, an American military drone fired missiles at a suspected terror camp in the jungles of the southern Philippines based on intelligence that Umar Patek, one of the ringleaders of a 2002 terrorist attack in Bali, was hiding at the camp. The missile strike, which the government of Manila announced publicly as a Philippine military operation, missed Patek but killed several others. The military was never able to determine how many of them were followers of Umar Patek and how many were women and children. The ballooning budgets for special operations also allowed JSOC to buy new eavesdropping equipment that gave commandos the ability to collect intelligence inside Pakistan from the sky. Beechcraft airplanes would regularly take off from airstrips in Afghanistan, fly over the spine of mountains separating Afghanistan and Pakistan, and turn into flying cell phone towers. Inside the Beechcraft planes, a device called a Typhoon Box housed dozens of phone numbers that military spies suspected were used by Pakistani militants. The device could identify when one of the numbers was being used and pinpoint its location. Even if a phone was switched off, JSOC had the ability to turn the phone on. It would then give away the precise coordinates of whoever was carrying it. After the new deals were struck with the CIA, JSOC operatives that had been sheep-dipped and turned into CIA officers could act on the intelligence with ground operations in Pakistan. 1 year after the mission into Bajor was scotched, the CIA once again picked up information about a gathering of military leaders, once again in the Bajor agency, in the tribal areas. The tiny village of Damodola had been under surveillance for some time since an Al-Qaeda captive, Abu Faraj al-Libi, told Pakistani intelligence officers he had once met Ayman al-Zawahiri at the house of Bakhtapur Khan, a Damodola villager. The CIA had carried out a drone strike in Damodola in January 2006, narrowly missing al-Zawahiri. And, months later, when the intelligence tip came in about another meeting in Damodola, a team of Navy SEALs was sent into the village. With the new procedures in place, CIA and military officials took only hours to analyze the intelligence and approve the operation. General John Abizaid, commander of United States Central Command, was in Washington when the CIA received the intelligence tip, and Abizaid jumped into a black SUV and raced to Langley in a motorcade. Shortly after Abizaid and Porter Goss had agreed on the final details of the raid, helicopters took off from Afghanistan and delivered the SEALs over the border into Bajor. The troops stormed the compound, wrestled several people to the floor, and bound them with plastic handcuffs. The prisoners were loaded into the helicopters and brought back into Afghanistan. Inside the counterterrorism center at Langley, CIA officers gathered around a television screen to watch a video feed from a Predator which was circling above the compound in Damodola, a staring, unblinking eye allowing spies thousands of miles away to watch the operation unfold. The SEALs captured no senior Al-Qaeda leaders on the operation. But the Damodola mission proved they could get into Pakistan undetected, conduct a snatch operation, and return to the other side of the border without Pakistan's government ever being wise to the mission. Chapter 8. A War by Proxy. A Somali proverb. Me and my nation against the world, me and my clan against my nation, me and my family against the clan, me and my brother against the family, me against my brother. By spring 2006, the CIA operatives in Nairobi, Kenya, were loading unmarked cargo planes with rocket-propelled grenades, mortars, and AK-47s, and flying the shipments to airstrips controlled by Somali warlords. Along with the weapons, they sent suitcases full of cash, about $200,000 for each warlord, as payment for their services in the fight against terrorism. For a group of men who had been trying to kill one another at various times over the years, the warlords had no qualms about working together once the CIA opened up its coffers. They even managed to come up with a Washington-friendly name for their partnership, the Alliance for the Restoration of Peace and Counterterrorism, or ARPCT. The name was unintentionally ironic, given the brutal history of some of the warlords like Abdi Hassan Awali Kebdeed and Mohammed Kanyari Afrah. Even in parts of the CIA, the group became the butt of jokes. Some American spies compared the acronym ARPCT with Spectre, the global terrorist organization from the James Bond films. Jose Rodriguez had signed off on a plan developed by spies in Nairobi to escalate a program of running guns and money to the warlords, who had convinced the Americans they would battle a burgeoning radical threat in the chaotic, impoverished nation. The collection of warlords, some of the same men who had dispatched gunmen to kill Army Rangers and Delta Force commandos in 1993, had been on the CIA's payroll in 2002. They had helped the CIA hunt down members of Al-Qaeda's East Africa cell, some of whom had been smuggled out of Somalia to CIA black sites. But the covert operation in 2006 was a more formal arrangement, and it turned into a Washington-sanctioned boondoggle for the warlords. The spiraling chaos in Iraq had not only drawn soldiers and spies away from the war in Afghanistan, it had also inspired a new generation of young Muslims to take up arms against the United States. At that time, drafts of a classified intelligence report circulating through American spy agencies laid bare the metastasizing problem of radicalization in the Muslim world. The final report concluded that Iraq had become a cause célèbre for jihadists, breeding a deep resentment of U.S. involvement in the Muslim world and cultivating supporters for the global jihadist movement. The report, a national intelligence estimate, predicted that an increasingly decentralized global jihad movement would splinter even further, with regional militant groups proliferating. The landscape was changing dramatically, and countries in North Africa, East Africa, and impoverished parts of the Arabian Peninsula were becoming increasingly unstable. In Yemen, 23 militants linked to Al-Qaeda escaped from a local jail using spoons and broken table legs to dig a tunnel. They likely had help from members of Yemen's security services who were sympathetic to the prisoners' cause from the days of the Soviet war in Afghanistan. As one Yemeni official explained the inside job to the New York Times, "You have to remember, these officers used to escort people from Sana'a to Pakistan during the Afghan jihad. People made relationships, and that doesn't change so easily." Interpol issued an urgent global alert seeking the arrests of the 23 men, but most did not go far. They stayed in Yemen, forming the core of a group that would eventually name itself Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. Then there was Somalia, and the rise to prominence of a small, stubby man with almond-shaped eyeglasses and, protruding from his chin, a tuft of hair that he dyed with red henna. Hassan Dahir Awais led the Shura Council of Somalia's Islamic Courts Union, a loose federation of clan elders, businessmen, and magnates who had joined together to bring order to Somalia's chaos by imposing Islamic Sharia law. The courts, which for years had been dominated by moderates, were widely popular in Somalia because they offered a reprieve from decades of warlordism. But by late 2005, Awais's influence over the ICU had turned the organization into a larger version of his Sharia court in the port city of Merka, a platform for preaching an uncompromising brand of Islam that regularly meted out punishments like stoning adulterers and severing the hands of thieves. Awais had been on an American list of top terror suspects for years, and the CIA had linked him to the Al-Qaeda cell in East Africa that had carried out the 1998 embassy bombings in Kenya and Tanzania. And yet he operated in plain sight, making high-profile trips to Dubai and moving openly among cities in Somalia. Under his command were a band of young, committed gunmen who had taken to calling themselves Al-Shabaab, Arabic for the youth. The group would roam the streets of Mogadishu, hunting and killing anyone believed to have pledged allegiance to Somalia's transitional federal government, a weak and corrupt organization created by the United Nations that had little control inside the country. Locals suspected of spying for the Americans were shot on sight. The CIA had not kept a permanent station inside Somalia for years, so the job of monitoring events inside the country fell to the clandestine officers in neighboring Kenya. The CIA station in Nairobi had grown significantly since the September 11 attacks, getting more money and personnel after CIA Director Porter Goss decided that the agency needed to beef up its presence in Africa and reopen some of its previously shuttered stations on the continent. During the final months of 2005 and into 2006, alarming cables from spies in Nairobi arrived in Langley, warning about the growing influence of the red-bearded Hassan Dahir Awais and the Al-Shabaab gunmen. Some of the reports concluded that the young radicals inside the Islamic Courts Union, including a gangly veteran of the Afghanistan War named Adan Hashi Farah Aero, could feather the nest for Al-Qaeda operatives to set up a new base in Somalia. But as much as Osama bin Laden and his followers might have wanted to establish a home in Somalia, the group over the years had confronted some of the same problems in the war-ravaged country that the Americans had. Put simply, Al-Qaeda didn't understand Somalia, and a plan by the group to flee to Somalia once the war in Afghanistan had begun had failed miserably. Arab militants who arrived in the country had trouble navigating the dizzying array of clans and subclans knit into the fabric of Somali culture and found themselves being extorted by clan elders at every turn. Rather than unite under a single banner to expel Westerners from the country, Somalis decided they would rather fight one another. Al-Qaeda militants, adherents to the radical Wahhabi strain of Islam, could not relate to the more moderate Sufism that the vast majority of Somalis practice. Somalis had a reputation for being tremendous gossips, and the foreign visitors grew angry that they couldn't keep secrets. All told, the chaotic African country by the sea seemed very different from the mountains of Pakistan and Afghanistan. This was hardly clear at the time to anyone in military or intelligence circles in Washington, and the alarming CIA reports out of Nairobi started getting attention at the White House. But what exactly was to be done if Somalia was going the way of Afghanistan? With the ghosts of the Black Hawk Down episode, the 1993 Battle of Mogadishu, still haunting the halls of the Pentagon, Army generals already had made it clear they might resign before the United States attempted another significant military intervention in Somalia. Besides, the wars elsewhere were sapping the ranks of soldiers and Marines, and the Pentagon could hardly spare troops for the Horn of Africa beyond what it had committed to the bare-bones task force in Djibouti, operating out of a former French Foreign Legion camp there. With the Bush administration convinced that Somalia was a problem that needed to be solved, the White House turned to the CIA to find a proxy army to fight a new war for Mogadishu. So was born the Alliance for the Restoration of Peace and Counterterrorism. The warlords of the ARPCT were hardly discreet about their ties to Washington and bragged openly about how much the CIA was paying them. But the tradecraft used by the Americans was also shoddy, making it readily apparent that the alliance was a CIA front. The gun shipments and money drops were broadcast in the local press. Agency officers supplied the warlords with contact information to use when they needed more supplies, and rumors spread through the capital that the CIA men had even given out an email address to use when the warlords needed more guns and money. The clumsiness of the CIA had divided officials inside the American embassy in Nairobi, a fortress built after the 1998 bombing had destroyed the previous building. The entire operation was being run by the CIA's station chief in Kenya, but diplomats at the compound began writing cables back to State Department headquarters, warning about blowback from the covert support to the warlords. In one of the cables, Leslie Rowe, the embassy's second-ranking officer, described the anger among African officials about the CIA effort. Michael Zorick, the State Department's political officer for Somalia, sent a scathing cable to Washington criticizing the warlord policy and complaining that the CIA was running guns to some of the biggest thugs in Somalia. Soon afterward, Zorick was reassigned to Chad. Just as some of these officers had warned, the covert operation blew up in the CIA's face. Instead of weakening the Islamists, it tipped the balance in Somalia in the other direction. Somalis began to embrace the Islamic Courts Union as the way to rid the country of foreign influence and finally bring an end to the warlord rule that had balkanized the country. During a meeting of American ambassadors from East Africa and Yemen in May 2006, the American officials could already see things unraveling inside Mogadishu. With nobody able to agree about what the next steps should be, the ambassadors agreed on the importance of changing the conversation from the fighting in the Somali capital toward positive U.S. steps to help restore Somali institutions. What had once been a standoff turned into a rout as the Islamists drove the CIA-backed warlords out of Mogadishu. The ICU consolidated its power in the capital. Even more disastrous for Washington, the Battle of Mogadishu gave even greater influence inside the ICU to Hassan Dahir Alweis and the radical band of Al-Shabaab gunmen. Hank Crumpton, the former spy at the CIA's counterterrorist center, watched the disaster unfold from his desk at the State Department, where he had taken a job as the coordinator for counterterrorism. The job carried the lofty title of ambassador at large, but was hobbled by its location inside an underfunded and occasionally dysfunctional diplomatic machinery. For Crumpton, the CIA's warlord adventure in Somalia was a classic example of Washington turning to covert action when a problem seemed too difficult to solve in a different way. What do you do when you can't figure out what to do in Somalia? Here's some money, here's some weapons, now go, he said. Absent a foreign policy, covert action isn't going to work, he said. And if you can describe to me the U.S. government's foreign policy in Somalia in 2006, or even now, I will give you a $10 bill. The CIA's station chief in Nairobi took the brunt of the withering internal criticism. Jose Rodriguez pulled the officer from Kenya, and the CIA decided it had had enough with Somalia for the time being. With the Islamic courts now in power in Mogadishu, Bush officials began speaking about Somalia as a new terror state. Jendai Fraser, the State Department's senior official for Africa policy, made public speeches during the last half of 2006 about direct connections between the ICU and Al-Qaeda and bluntly labeled the ICU terrorists. The collapse of the CIA effort in Somalia had, for the moment, exhausted the Bush administration's options for dealing with the rise of the Islamists there. But where governments feared to tread, new opportunities were emerging for private military companies and would-be contractors eager to wade into the anarchy in East Africa. The conditions were perfect. The United States government was unwilling to send many of its own into Somalia, but it was eager to spend money so others could. By the middle of 2006, Somalia was turning into the outsourced war. Just a week after the CIA-backed warlords fled Mogadishu, a commercial jet carrying a middle-aged woman from the horse country of Northern Virginia landed in Nairobi. Michelle Ballarin was the president of Select Armor, a small company with a contract to sell body armor to the Los Angeles County Fire Department, but one that had found no success winning any big Pentagon deals. But her ambitions were far grander than being a fourth-tier defense contractor. When she landed in Kenya in June 2006, she was scheduled to have a private meeting with Abdullahi Yusuf Ahmed, the man leading Somalia's UN-backed government in exile from his luxurious hotel suite in Nairobi. It seemed a strange thing that a woman who had the appearance of a wealthy heiress would have an audience with the leader of Somalia's feckless transitional federal government. But Ballarin had traveled to the Horn of Africa several times before and had developed something of a cult following in some sectors of the Somali political class. She claimed to train and breed Lipizzana stallions, the famous white horses that performed dressage, and wore her wealth wherever she went. She traveled with Louis Vuitton bags, expensive jewelry, and Gucci clothing. If the idea was to dazzle the residents of one of the world's poorest countries, it had the intended effect. Somalis began referring to her by a one-word moniker, the Arabic word for princess. They called her Amira. It was a long way from West Virginia, where she had first made a name for herself during the 1980s as a Republican candidate in a staunchly Democratic state. She had tried to piggyback on Ronald Reagan's popularity in the hopes of winning a congressional seat representing Morgantown, the location of West Virginia University. Just 31 at the time, she had funded much of her 1986 campaign with money from her first husband, a man several decades older than her who had landed on the Normandy beaches on D-Day and amassed a small fortune as a real estate developer. But she also hustled to raise money on the campaign trail by showing off her skills as a concert pianist during political fundraisers. Trying to paint the Democratic incumbent as out of step with the values of West Virginian families, she criticized her opponent during the final weeks of the campaign for his vote to spend taxpayer money to print Playboy in Braille. She even made hay of his refusal to show up to one debate by cutting up a piece of cardboard, pasting his face on it, and debating him anyway. She was roundly defeated in the election. After the death of her first husband, she married Gino Ballarin, a former bartender at Manhattan's 21 Club who went on to own and manage the private Georgetown Club in Washington. The couple threw parties at their home in Virginia, eventually earning themselves a listing in the Green Book, a directory of socially prominent Washingtonians that was a Bible for the city's old money elite. In 1997, she spoke to a reporter about how pleased she was to get into the Green Book with all her friends, neighbors, and other supporters of equine sports. The book symbolizes old ways of doing things which have really rattled against change, she said. It symbolizes a gentler way of going about living. The Ballarins by then were living on an estate in Markham, Virginia, with the grand name Wolf's Crag. It was once the home of Turner Ashby, a Confederate cavalry commander who gained fame during Stonewall Jackson's Shenandoah Valley campaign and earned the nickname the Black Knight of the Confederacy. But Michelle Ballarin seemed to have bigger plans than living a genteel life of polo matches and lawn parties. During the 1990s and early 2000s, she began a number of business ventures, from real estate development to international finance to selling body armor. As she describes it, it was a casual meeting with a group of Somali Americans set up by a friend of hers from the Freemason Lodge in Washington that sparked her interest in the war-racked country, and the transformation of Michelle into Amira began. She started traveling to Africa, and soon the devoutly Christian woman who played the organ at her church each Sunday became entranced by the teachings of Sufism, a mystical branch of Islam once dominant on the Indian subcontinent and North Africa. Sufism had lost ground after the breakup of the Ottoman Empire had spawned more muscular forms of Islam. but it is still practiced widely in Somalia. Ballarin became convinced that promoting Sufi groups inside the country was the best way to diminish what she saw as a toxic influence of strict Wahhabism that had gained a foothold in the Horn of Africa with the help of rich Saudi donors who sent money there to build radical schools and mosques. Her public work in Somalia made her appear like just another rich do-gooder pushing airy-fairy development projects, but there was a darker, edgier side to her projects. When the Islamic Courts Union took control in Mogadishu, she saw an opportunity to take advantage of the vast, ungoverned areas in Somalia to set up bases for a resistance movement to drive the Islamists out of power, as well as to nurture business ventures in the country. The horsewoman of Virginia would insert herself into the chaos. At the meeting with President Abdullahi Yusuf Ahmed, Ballarin discussed her plan to set up a base in Somalia's northern port city of Berbera. The city was home to an abandoned airstrip that NASA had once designated as an emergency landing strip for the space shuttle, and Ballarin figured that the site could be turned into a hub for commercial traffic and a location to train anti-Al-Shabaab forces. President Ahmed, a political figurehead seeking refuge inside a plush hotel in Nairobi, was hardly in a position to sign off on Ballarin's plan. But when she emerged from the meeting, Ballarin was elated. Days later, she dashed off an email to several of her business partners in the United States, including Chris Farina, the head of a Florida-based private security firm called ATS Worldwide. "Boys, successful meeting with President Abdullahi Yusuf and his chief of staff personnel," Ballarin wrote. "He has appointed his chief of presidential protocol as our go-to during this phase." Later in the email, Ballarin implied that the CIA was aware of her plans and that she was planning to meet a CIA contact of hers in New York. But Farina urged caution, writing back to warn that the plan shouldn't go off half-cocked. A forced entry operation into Mogadishu at this point, without the addition of follow-on forces who can capitalize on the momentum initiative of the initial op, will result in a replay of Dien Bien Phu, he wrote, referring to the French debacle in Indochina in 1954. Farina also told Ballarin that perhaps the CIA wasn't the best partner for their efforts, perhaps wise advice given what had just happened in the country. A better bet, he said, was the Pentagon. She eventually took his advice, but it would be another 2 years before she managed to convince the Pentagon to fund her adventures inside Somalia. The Islamic Courts Union's takeover in Mogadishu at first brought a calm to the capital that it had not known for years. A city that warlords had divided up was now open. Children who had grown up within a mile of the sea but who had never actually seen the water because it meant crossing into the zone of a rival warlord were free to spend the day at the beach. But a series of pronouncements that summer by the Al-Shabaab wing of the Islamic Courts Union, which had in effect seized control of the ICU movement, turned many Somalis against the new leaders. Foreign films were banned, as were soccer games. Women were forced to veil their faces. Most unpopular of all was a ban on khat, the narcotic green leaf that almost all Somali men chew daily to bring on a mild, pleasant haze. The concerns in Washington about the imposition of Sharia law in Mogadishu were stoked by a stream of intelligence fed to the Bush administration by Ethiopian officials who feared that a new Al-Qaeda safe haven might be emerging on their eastern border. Animosities between Ethiopians and Somalis ran deep. During the 1970s, the two countries fought a territorial battle over the Ogaden region of Ethiopia that became a proxy conflict of the Cold War, with the United States supporting Somalia and the Soviet Union giving military supplies to the Ethiopians. But the fall of the Soviet Union reshuffled the alliances in Africa, as it did in so many other parts of the world. During the 1990s, with Washington worrying about the spread of Islamic fundamentalism, Ethiopia and its Christian majority came to be seen as natural allies for the United States. So, during the summer of 2006, when Ethiopian officials began to talk openly about the possibility of invading Somalia to dismantle the Islamic Courts Union and Al-Shabaab, some in Washington saw an opportunity. The strategy to arm a ragtag collection of warlords had failed, but maybe the Ethiopian army could become America's new proxy force in Somalia. Within weeks of the Islamist takeover in Mogadishu, General John Abizaid of U.S. Central Command visited Addis Ababa, Ethiopia's capital, during a tour of East Africa. During meetings with military, CIA, and State Department officials at the American Embassy, he asked about what Ethiopia's military might need if they were going to drive their tanks toward Mogadishu. Abizaid made it clear that while the United States would not push Ethiopia to invade, it would try to ensure that an invasion was a success. He also met with Ethiopian officials and offered to share American intelligence about ICU military positions inside Somalia. Back in Washington, Director of National Intelligence John D. Negroponte authorized spy satellites to be trained on Somalia to provide detailed pictures for the Ethiopian troops. The idea, as one American official stationed in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, in 2006 described it, was to get the Ethiopians to fight our war. The Ethiopian invasion would also provide cover for American commando missions into Somalia, launched from a base in the coffee-growing region of eastern Ethiopia. During the summer and fall of 2006, when it increasingly looked like Ethiopian troops might invade Somalia, Navy Seabees arrived at the base in Dire Dawa, 300 miles east of Addis Ababa. Officially, the Seabees were there on a humanitarian mission. Treacherous rains had flooded the plains around Dire Dawa and sent a 10-foot wall of water crashing through the town, and the Seabees helped set up tents and give emergency medical care for the 10,000 people displaced by the floods. But besides the humanitarian supplies, the C-130 transport planes arriving in Dire Dawa also began ferrying in war materiel for a group of Navy SEALs and Delta Force commandos who were trickling into Ethiopia as part of a secret JSOC unit called Task Force 88. Their plan was to use Ethiopia's invasion of Somalia as a cover to get into the country and hunt down senior ICU operatives. The mission in Somalia had been authorized under Donald Rumsfeld's 2004 order permitting military commandos to infiltrate countries that had traditionally been off-limits to American soldiers. In early January 2007, just days after the first Ethiopian tank columns rumbled over the border and artillery batteries started pounding Islamic Courts Union military installations in southwest Somalia, Task Force 88 began its missions inside the country. Attached to the group were surveillance experts from Grey Fox, the Pentagon's clandestine spying unit that would eventually change its code name to Task Force Orange. The group carried specialized equipment, allowing it to pinpoint the locations of ICU commanders by intercepting their telephone communications. In addition to the special operations troops, two AC-130 gunships armed with 105mm cannons and Gatling guns arrived at the airstrip in eastern Ethiopia, and in early January, the gunships launched an attack on a small fishing village in the swamplands of southern Somalia. They were acting on intelligence that Aden Hashi Farah Eiro, the young Al-Shabaab leader, was hiding in the village of Ras Kamboni. Hours after a barrage of missiles, American and Ethiopian troops sifted through the wreckage and found a passport of Aero's, stained with blood. The Americans assumed that Aero would not have lasted long if he had been wounded in the strike, but nobody was sure where he had gone. The AC-130 gunships carried out a second strike 2 weeks later against a different Islamist commander. But the attack killed civilians instead of its intended target. The clandestine missions in Somalia in early 2007 had mixed results. American troops and intelligence aided the Ethiopian offensive through southern Somalia and led to a swift retreat by Islamic Courts Union troops. But the JSOC missions had failed to capture or kill any of the most senior Islamist commanders or members of the Al-Qaeda cell responsible for the 1998 embassy bombings. And beyond the narrow manhunt, the larger Ethiopian occupation of Somalia could fairly be called a disaster. The Bush administration had secretly backed the operation, believing that Ethiopian troops could drive the Islamist Courts Union out of Mogadishu and provide military protection for the UN-backed transitional government. The invasion had achieved that first objective, but the impoverished Ethiopian government had little interest in spending money to keep its troops in Somalia to protect the corrupt transitional government. Within weeks of the end of fighting, senior Ethiopian officials declared that they had met their military objectives and began talking publicly about a withdrawal. The Ethiopian army had waged a bloody and indiscriminate campaign against its most hated enemy. Using lead-footed urban tactics, Ethiopian troops lobbed artillery shells into crowded marketplaces and dense neighborhoods, killing thousands of civilians. Discipline in the Ethiopian ranks broke down, and soldiers went on rampages of looting and gang rape. One young man interviewed by the nonprofit group Human Rights Watch spoke of witnessing Ethiopians kill his father and then rape his mother and sisters. The occupation by the hated Ethiopian troops turned into a recruiting bonanza for Al-Shabaab, and the group grew in strength. Insurgents planted roadside bombs and used other guerrilla tactics that militants in Iraq and Afghanistan had used with great success. Foreign fighters flooded into Somalia. Jihadi internet sites involved the name Abu Ragal, an infamous traitor in the Muslim faith who had helped the Ethiopian army march on Mecca. The fighters came from Morocco and from Algeria. And they came from Minnesota. Not long after the Ethiopian invasion, 20 American students from the little Mogadishu neighborhood of Minneapolis boarded planes and went to Somalia to wage jihad against the Christian invaders. Among them was Shirwa Ahmed, a community college dropout who loved basketball and spent most of his days doing odd jobs and memorizing the lyrics to rap songs. He had become so enraged by the arrival of the Ethiopians in Somalia that he made his way to the Horn of Africa, where he joined Al-Shabaab. In October of the following year, he drove a car packed with explosives into a government building in Puntland, a region of northern Somalia. He was the first ever American suicide bomber.